My guest is Ian Ross this evening, and he joins me in the studio. Hello, Ian. How are you doing? All right.
Former journalist. How dare you, sir? I'll be a journalist till the day I die.
Present journalist. Well, I was.
It's one of those professions, you know, you don't actually ever give it up, I don't think.
I was looking through your CV. There isn't many you haven't worked for, really.
No. I'll tell you something. I did a mid-year in my career. I did about 18 months of freelancing, and I'm one of the few people I've had pieces published in every national paper and every Sunday national paper in this country.
Wow.
Which is great, and I really like that.
Yeah, well, it is quite a CV. I mean, the Southport Visitor, that's what got you going, wasn't
it, That's what got me onto drinking heavily.
Right,
it
OK.
It was the classic sort of start of a career, really. I was going to say weekly paper, but the Southport Visitor in those days was Britain's only tri-weekly paper.
Right.
Came out Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays, which is very strange when you've got odd. You either get used to weekly deadlines or daily deadlines. We had three deadlines per week. It was really odd, but it was great. I mean, the people were really good. I'll tell you a story. When I went to journalism college in Sheffield. And even then, you're talking 74, 75, long time ago now. The media was a really popular career choice, so it was really hard, even for those who'd been on the pre-entry course, to get in. So I applied for, like I did, a scattergun approach, papers all over the place, got an interview, Southport Visitor, Now, I thought Southport was Southend.
Geographically, there's a bit of a difference.
Hand on the heart, I'd never heard of Southport. And I got on the train, I lived in Leeds at the time, got on the train in Leeds. I got off the train in Southport and I saw a sign saying Liverpool 15 miles. And I thought, oh no, I've got the wrong train here. And I had no idea where I was. And then it suddenly clicked that there is in fact a Southport and a Southend.
There is,
and I was
indeed,
in Southport. And I got the job and I was there for 3 years, which was fun.
They didn't ask you any geography questions in the interview.
No, that's never my strong point, though.
We're going to talk more about your career a little bit later on, but before we do that, you're now the head of global communications at You Are The Ref.
Yeah.
We've done a few things with You Are The Ref, actually, over the last year or so. I mean, this must be quite exciting because there's so much spotlight now on referees in football, isn't there?
It's really interesting. I mean, they approached me, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 months ago. They're based in Sheffield, and I went over and met them, and they're a really interesting, eccentric, eclectic bunch of people, mostly former referees. Keith Hackett is the co-founder there. A guy called Jock Waugh, who runs it, is a former Football League referee. They've also got Mark Halsey, Roger Dilks, etc. So they've got a real army of top-quality people. And, of course, since I joined, not because I joined, but since I joined, youaretheref.com has signed up Mark Clattenburg. So, you know, we've got the best referee in the world now on board. Mark came on primarily because we've just launched an online academy. And he's desperately keen that he helps the next generation of referees, not just in this country, but worldwide. I mean, in this country, it's seen almost as you're either elite or you're on the park on a Sunday morning. But there's a huge strata in between. Particularly in America, where football is now really, really growing again. We always say that every 10 years, don't we? But we've gone global, as you said, with the academy. And it's a fantastic idea because it literally means that those who subscribe, it's not that much per month, they can send in their queries. I've got a problem with this. What should I have done? Some of these people will actually get calls from Mark Clattenburg. He'll ring them up and tell them, as will Keith Hackett and Mark Halsey and stuff.
So is there an analysis sort of side to it as well? So on a Monday, if there's been games throughout the weekend, something's happened and we're all talking about it on a Monday, will you look at that and go into
detail?
Yeah, we
do. It's usually Keith Hackett who does it, who used to run the referees management group, who can occasionally be quite critical of the current PGMOL, they're called. He analyses the main points of the week. We've got a TV show that we show every week, the Ref Show, where we get probably Mark Halsey or Keith in, and then Danny Murphy or Mark Lawrence and people like that, Chris Waddle have been on, and they just go through. And it's really interesting because half the time, if you watch things like Match of the Day, you know, half the conversation in between the games is about refereeing decisions. And usually when you end up talking to your mates, it's either a great goal or it's, what was that all about, that referee? And it's really interesting. And it's the sort of thing which as a journalist who covered football for so long, maybe I didn't pay that much attention to referees.
Yeah,
but I do now.
I was going to say, has your respect for referees grown as a result of
this?
It has.
I went over there. We had a sort of two-day get-together with everybody involved. And it was really interesting to see, you know, 20 former referees and linesmen in a room having a laugh to see this. They've got the same camaraderie that players have. And they tell the same stories. And they've got risque stories about what happened to them during their career. And it was really interesting. And it's interesting to sit with people like that and just say to Keith, and Mark Halsey, for example, who was the worst player you ever had to deal with? Duh, duh, duh.
Who was it? Can you reveal?
Duncan Ferguson, I think, was it? But because instinctively, I suppose, journalists tend to ask the questions which supporters would ask. So I said to Mark Clattenburg, when I met Mark Clattenburg for the first time about 4 weeks ago, and the first thing that amazed me was I realised as he walked in the room, I'd never heard Mark Clattenburg speak.
Yeah.
Because he's not allowed to speak. And of course, he opens his mouth and he's got a Geordie accent, which really threw me for some reason. I wasn't expecting it. But I sort of drew up, because at the moment he's still tying up his departure from the Premier League, so he can't do the interviews, but he will do shortly. And you will get one here on this fine station of yours.
We have asked.
You will get one.
You're right, though. I mean, there is... You don't kind of think that referees are human, but he's a big Newcastle fan,
yeah,
isn't he, Clattenburg?
Yeah. He's from County Durham.
Yeah.
But I gave him a list of questions that he could expect to be asked when he started doing media. And they were the things that you would ask and that anybody listening to this would ask. What was your favourite ground to go to? What was your least favourite? What was your best decision, your worst decision? How many times did you watch Match of the Day from behind the settee? That sort of thing.
Mm.
Because supporters would love to hear that from referees. But, of course, at the moment, because of the rules and regulations and red tape, they're denied the chance to talk to referees. So many times during my time at Everton, there'd be a contentious decision. Some of the press lads would pull me and say, can you just ask the referee whether he will explain his... And, of course, you go down, you knock on the door, and they just say no.
Well, there must be a reason for this, because we've been going on about this for years. The referee needs to come out and explain his decisions. It never gets anywhere, does it?
No, it doesn't. And it's down to their association, and I think a measure of fear within the Premier League and the Football League. Because if you talk to referees, as I have been doing since working with You Are the Ref, most of them would be perfectly happy to come out and say, I did that because this and this. It's the same with the video assistant ref thing now. You know, at least people, it's going, not going well, I can see, but at least people can now understand why the decision was made, hopefully.
Do you think that's just a fine-tuning thing, though, with the video thing? I mean, it's in its infancy, isn't it? We're all getting used to it as fans, players, officials, whatever.
The problem is that those who've opposed it for so long are sitting back and rubbing their hands in glee here because they said, no, it'll ruin the game, it'll break the game up. And their main argument always was the delays would be too long, that the decisions, if they're going to be looked at by a video assistant referee, wouldn't be quick enough. And, of course, the classic one was the other night in the Confederation Cup final.
Yeah.
Where, 5 minutes? And the referee actually doesn't bother with the video assistant. He goes across to the touchline and watches it himself on a screen. That's not the idea.
No, I mean...
And even then, he gets it completely wrong.
Well, this is the problem with it, though, isn't it? We've seen... There was one in the England friendly, wasn't there, in France? Well, I mean, people were disagreeing about that 48 hours after it happened, so it's by no means...
The problem with it is that if you don't have this sort of system, then the decision comes and it goes and people say it was wrong or it was right, and it's gone then. They forget about it. With the video assistant referees, because inevitably they'll be releasing stills and footage of what they've been looking at, and it leaves the official who's the fourth, fifth, sixth official, whatever you call him, he's really vulnerable, because if he studies a video replay and still gets it wrong, then he can't do it again, surely. That's the problem you've got. But it is, it's teething trouble, I suppose. I hope it's teething trouble, because it's going to come in and we'll be stuck with it.
I think it's also, the argument is, well, it's worked really well in cricket and rugby.
Yeah.
But with cricket, it's mainly LBW decisions, which are a bit more cut and dry, aren't they, really?
Yeah, they are. And I think with cricket, more so than with rugby, it does heighten the sense of tension in the ground.
Great. Yeah, they got the music
going, and everybody's looking at the screen and stuff and waiting for it. But whether that will work with football, I don't know. I was just dismayed with what I saw in the Confederation Cup final, because to take 5 minutes, having missed... Well, he didn't even miss it. I mean, it's such a bad decision in the end. It's either nothing or it's a red card. It cannot be a yellow card.
Yeah, yeah.
See, I've been talking to my referee friends. I understand this.
You're going to be one of the panels.
I'm going to have to go back writing, I think.
Ian, you're also involved in something called, is it WESPA? Have I spelled
that? You have, the World Elite Sports Performance Academy.
Tell us about that then, for
those. That was launched on the Wirral by a former colleague of mine at Everton, Alistair Savmarimuto, a former rugby union international player. The idea is to go right at grassroots level, to tap into the untapped regions of sport and to encourage kids. And WESPA does that with an array of Olympians, world-class coaches, England coaches, physios, trainers, the lot, you wouldn't believe it. Started off, massive success on the Wirral. We've moved across to Liverpool now. We're in the Liverpool schools, we're in all the Wirral schools. It went so well that within 12 months we'd launched WESPA Fire Netball Team, which did brilliantly in their first season from scratch. We've just launched WESPA Athletics, and there's a whole array of things that are coming along. And it's a fantastic programme for kids. It costs them next to nothing to take part. We use the word elite because the idea of WESPA is to produce elite athletes. Our aim is to produce podium athletes at Olympics, World Championships, European Championships. And we've had some fantastic success so far. Some of the kids who came in, who were just raw talent, are now county level. Some have gone on to international honours. And it's been a magnificent success. And we've just moved into our new plush headquarters in Birkenhead. Big gym, all the treatment rooms and stuff there. And it's really, really catching on. And the plan is that we will move it around the country because it's a question of getting it right, making sure it works. And once you've got the model, then you can roll it out anywhere. It's very simple to do. Yeah. And, you know, we've had so many requests from different parts of the country saying, when are you coming to Bristol, Aberdeen, Isle of Man, et cetera, et cetera. So it'll be Manchester next probably and then somewhere down south.
Manchester and then the world.
And then the world.
How's your health, actually? I was talking to Ian Kennedy, our sports editor, and I said, I can't remember the last time I saw Ian. And Ian said, I think it was on the Panorama.
Yeah, it was on Panorama, yeah.
Because for those who can't remember, you had a heart bypass, is it 2 years ago?
2 years ago,
yeah. And it was screened on Panorama. And I had actually forgotten about this until he mentioned it again.
I hadn't forgotten about it.
Funny that. How did all that come about?
Well, I was fine. No history of heart trouble in either me or my family. None at all. Just started with chest pains, which I took to be heartburn because, as I now know through talking to surgeons and stuff, angina pains and heartburn pains are almost identical, which is why so many people die. They think they've got heartburn. It's not heartburn. It's your body warning you that your heart's not in good shape. Anyway, I eventually went for an angiogram, which is a very strange procedure where they push something through your veins and check. And the good thing is that this is at Broad Green, a fantastic place. It's like lying on the deck of the Starship Enterprise with all these things whizzing around you. And they can come over with, literally, as soon as they finish the test and tell you what's wrong with you. And they came over and said, you need 5 bypasses.
Whoa.
Ooh. To which I replied, I thought you could only have 3. And they said, well, you've managed to block up the main 3 and 2 other ones as well. So I was set to go in a couple of months later, but I went in early because I was suffering pain when just sitting down, which is a bad sign. Went to Broad Green, had the operation, 9.5 hours, which I can't remember, self-evidently.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the next bit either. I woke up, I was okay, I was talking to my kids, not a problem. Then I started to complain I couldn't breathe. And it turned out I'd got MRSA, and I had complete respiratory failure. My lungs collapsed completely. And the problem with that is, again, you learn these things when you've been through them. If your lungs collapse, the surgeon or the doctors cannot reinflate them. Your own body must reinflate them, otherwise you don't make it. So they put me on life support in a coma for 3 weeks, I think I was in. They told my kids a couple of times I wasn't going to make it because I was so ill. But I did, strangely.
Yeah.
Again, you know, I came out of the coma and they told my kids that if he comes out of the coma... he won't know what's going on. He'll be bolshy. He'll be psychotic. And I was all those things. You don't know you've been in a... I didn't know I'd been in a coma for another 2 weeks. It took 2 weeks before people were explaining to me what had been going on. The first clue was when I looked down at my scars and I thought, my goodness, they've healed quickly. because I thought it had been a couple of days. It had been like a month, you know, and all the stitches had gone. But I wouldn't recommend being in a coma. It's not quite what people think it is. People think it's a long, deep sleep, and it's not.
Oh, right, OK. I hope I don't ever have to
it's not great.
That.
It's not a fun. And I tell you what, the first thing I thought of when I came out of the coma and came out of hospital, I ended up in intensive care for 7 weeks, I think, 8 weeks, I can't remember. The first thing I thought about when I came out was I felt almost like getting in touch with families who've got a family member in a coma and just saying, please don't think for a second that he's resting or she's resting peacefully. Because if they're going through for years what I've just been through for 3 weeks, it's not great.
So, I mean, what's it like then?
I had to have it explained to me. My surgeon explained it to me. He said, when you close down, if a brain can't see or touch or smell or hear, and I was in a deep coma, so people always talk to you when you're in a coma. They try and... But I didn't hear any of that. But if you do that to a brain, if you close down all its outlets, it will build its own reality. It has to do something.
Right.
So it immediately, I called it Planet A, I'm lying in a bed with 14 tubes in me in a coma. Planet B, I'm in a completely different world. And it's not a dream, and you don't know it's a dream, and you don't know it's a coma. It is another world, and that is your world.
God, that's, I know. It's so difficult to get your head around, really.
Some of it was just bizarre. Some of it was frightening. Some of it was awful. Some of it was okay. There were people in there I knew. And I remember when I eventually woke up, one of the nurses in intensive care, who had been trying to convince me that I'd been in a coma, she said, can I just ask you one question? Do you know where you are? I said, yeah, I'm in a clinic in Northern Ireland. And that's where I've been on Planet B. And it took her 2 or 3 days to convince me that I wasn't in Northern Ireland, I was in Broad Green.
That's scary,
isn't
it?
And it took maybe 4 or 5 weeks before my own family and friends actually convinced me. Graham Sharp kept coming in to see me. And every time he came in, I was just out of it. So he ate the grapes that he brought for me. Very kind. Okay. Ex-footballers are like that.
Sounds like Sharpie,
he does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it was an experience I wouldn't care to repeat.
But it was on telly.
I know, the telly programme was quite misleading, really, in a way, because it went from saying, oh, Ian got MRSA, to the final shot of me walking out at the end to see my grandkids. And it made no mention of the fact that I'd nearly died, that I'd been in a coma, that I'd been in there for 8 weeks. It just seemed to be... And it was weird because a lot of people, a lot of journalistic mates, saw that programme without knowing the story. They didn't know I was in the programme. And a lot of them said, oh, my God, we thought they were going to say at the end that you died, because it looked like it was building up to say...
Yeah, yeah.
But mercifully, I didn't. Although there was a moment when I knew I could have given up. A lot of people who are in comas and that ill... My doctor told me, choose to give up. You can. I now know that you can give up. And I had one point where I knew if I didn't fight very, very hard, I would have gone. So that I had the chance to go, I wanted to go.
So you made a determined effort not to go, in effect.
Yeah. I'll tell you. Want me to tell you the story? Yeah. I was in what looked like the foyer of a hotel. And there was a sliding glass door in front of me. And people were walking back and forth. People I knew. Bill Kenwright was there, strangely. Duncan Ferguson was there. I don't know why. Sir Philip Carter, friends and family. To my left, there was a guy behind a table who was the commissioner. And I was sitting in a chair, a very comfortable chair. And I wanted to get up and go out the glass doors. And I couldn't get out of the chair. And I was fighting, struggling to get out of the chair. And I turned to the guy and I just said, excuse me, can you help me get out of this chair? And he just looked at me and said, no. He said, you either get out yourself or you will never get out of that chair. And I knew then that if I'd sunk back, or I suspect if I'd sunk back into that chair, that would have been it. But I fought and I fought and I fought. And eventually I got out of the chair. And I can't remember the next bit. But that's the one abiding memory from that is that that's probably... There were 2 days when I was critically ill. And... Having learned the code from hospitals, critically ill means that they suspect you might not make it.
Yes.
So that was the moment, I think, when I had a choice. And as I say, the doctor said a lot of people who end up in that state, if they're very elderly and very sick, they've got the choice. They can't fight anymore. They've no fight left in them. So they give up and they just go. which, you know, it's okay, but I wasn't ready to go.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that. It's amazing. let's talk about your time as a journalist. We've touched on the fact that you started the Visitor in Southport. Looking back on your time in your journalist days, how proud are you to work for all the, you know, a lot of the papers that I
mentioned?
Good.
I mean, it's one of those things, and I think it's more in hindsight when you look back. I left the Visitor after 3 years. The Echo rang me and said, we want you to come and work here, which was great. And I had, 8 or 9 years at the Post and Echo. And I loved it. We had a fantastic time. They were great people. And funnily enough, there's just been a book published about journalists from that era who reminiscing about their times there. And I made my little contribution. But it was great. It was there that I moved from doing... I was night news editor on the Daily Post. I did the music column. I did cinema reviews. I did crime for a while. And that's when I moved to football, probably 1981, 82. Howard had just taken over at Everton. So I moved from doing news to doing sport on the Daily Post.
It's interesting you say that, because a lot of people seem to do... I've got, you know, Tony Barrett would be one who was a news reporter on The Echo and then ended up being a very successful sports journalist. So...
You see, everybody always, a lot of people assume that if you move into journalism, you can move straight into doing football, sports, cinema. You can't do that if you do it properly. I mean, it's changed now because of social media and because the way newspapers are dying, in essence. But in those days, you couldn't do it. You had to train for 3 years as a news reporter. You had to pass a proficiency test, which is really hard. You know, you've got to have shorthand and you've got to have a certain level to pass it, etc. So people like myself, Tony Barrett, and people like Paul Joyce on The Times Now and stuff like that, Phil McNulty, we went through the traditional route. A lot of people now who say they're journalists are not really journalists, in my view. I'm a purist. I'm from the old school, really, who wants you to train for 3 years and struggle and have no money live in a garret flat in Toxteth and things like that. That's what you should be doing. But I worked on The Echo and I loved it. And I did football for 3 or 4 years there, won a couple of national awards. And then I just got a call one day from The Times just saying, do you want to come and work for us? And I said, I'd love to work for it's the most famous newspaper in the world. I said, but I don't want to go to London. I have no intention of going to London. He said, no, we don't want you. We want you to work, do the north of England for us. So I did. And I went from there to The Telegraph. And from there to The Guardian.
But you were covering Merseyside football in the glory era, weren't you? I mean, what was that like?
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
It was great.
Did it make the job easier, really?
It did. It made it really hard, though. I mean, it was, you know, you were doing 90-plus games a season. You were all over the place. And, of course, the year of the mid-80s, you were having to miss key Liverpool games in Europe because you were watching key Everton games in Europe. It was weird because there wasn't the careful dissecting of fixtures then. And it was wonderful because it was different. It's a different era. I mean, I feel really sorry for a lot of the guys who cover football now. They can't get near the players. We did. We were part. You know, I used to go on the team bus with Liverpool to away games. That's what it was like. You know, I used to sit next to Bob Paisley and stuff when they went away. And Everton, you know, you go pre-season with Everton. I mean, you were part of the crew. You were on the team bus to all the friendlies, and whenever they went out drinking or whatever they went out doing, I went with them.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. And it was one of those trust things, you know, what happens on tour stays on tour. And you know, they trusted you. I trusted them. They trusted me. That doesn't happen anymore.
But I mean, you become one of the lads, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
If you're on the team bus. I mean,
you do.
What was the atmosphere like?
It was great. And I remember the first time I did it, Liverpool were playing away at Fulham. It must have been a cup tie midweek. And I asked Peter Robinson, who was then in charge at Liverpool, you know, I'm struggling to get there and back. And he said, oh, you should come on the team bus if you want, not a problem. So they go down there and they won the game. And we all got on the bus. I think they won the game. We all got on the bus to go back, straight back, no overnight stays, straight back on the coach, straight back to Liverpool. And about 2 miles away from Craven Cottage, the bus just ground to a halt. Fish and chip shop. Fish and chips 28 times, please. Ronnie Moran, I think it was, went and got them, or Joe Fagan. And that's what it was like. But you're right. I mean, in those days, you were part of the team. So now when I bump into people any of them, the great Evertonians or the great Liverpudlians, Hanson, Dalglish, Rush, Reed, Southall, Stevens, Trevor Stevens, I know them all as friends because that's how close you became to them. They trusted you. And, you know, if first time you stitch up a football, you've had it.
Because, yeah, yeah.
But as I say, I don't even think these days that most of the guys covering football, they don't even get the chance to stitch them up because they can't get near them.
And you were there. I mean, I remember interviewing you on the anniversary of Heysel. You obviously covered Heysel. I think you were on the Daily Post.
Yeah, I was, yeah.
What was that experience like?
It's a bit vague now. I've got certain recollections. I mean, things happened that night which are sort of burns into your soul, really. I mean, you know, it was awful because obviously once it had all died down and they were obviously dead, we realised what was going on. We had supporters, Italians mostly, coming up to the press box and saying, I can't find my son or brother. And I remember going downstairs to the gym, I think it was, which is a temporary morgue, and lifting up tarpaulins with this guy looking for his son.
Oh, man.
I know.
You're never going to forget
no,
that.
No, you're
you?
Not. But you do it out of instinct because you. It's just it. I mean, the funny thing was, obviously, the game went ahead. I can't remember anything about the game at all. And I wrote a match report. I can't remember writing a match report. You're in such a state of shock. But most of my memories about Heysel were, in retrospect, were walking up to the stadium. This is a European Cup final. And we all had obviously got the press bus, get off the press bus, walk through with your passes. Nobody looked at us. Nobody checked the passes. We just literally walked straight through the front gates at Heysel. We could have been anybody. And the clearest recollections are the following day when Peter Robinson rounded us all up. I think it was Liverpool pointing out that the stadium was completely unfit for anything, never mind a major football game. And we just stood on the terraces and the damn place was falling to pieces. You know, and the two sets of supporters had been divided by one line of chicken wire. And that's all there was, stopping the two fans getting the sets of fans pushing each other. And it was, you know, it's the ultimate cliche, disaster waiting to happen. And it was horrible. It was truly horrible. And as I say, I can't remember much about the aftermath.
Yeah, and as I said, you're on the Daily Post then. The Daily Post, of course, doesn't exist now.
No, I know.
How do you feel about that?
It's sad. I loved the Daily Post. When I went to the Post Necco, they had a system whereby the editorial staff used to switch. So you'd do 3 weeks on the Echo and then a week of nights, because a lot of people didn't like working. I loved working nights. I was a single bloke. The guys who were working nights on the desk were great. You know, we had a great time. And so I just suggested that we should just have a permanent Daily Post staff who were happy to work. It's usually from like 2 till midnight or maybe 4 till 2 o'clock or whatever. Generous sections in the pub over the road, the spiral staircase, obviously. But it was great. The camaraderie was fantastic. And I loved the paper. And I thought it was a great paper, the Daily Post. If I'd not worked for the Daily Post exclusively, then I wouldn't have gone on to the national papers, because if you look at the history of the Daily Post and the Echo, virtually, I think all the people who've gone on from the Post Necco to work for Nationals have come from the Daily Post, because in those days they could see it in London. It was on sale in London. So Times, The Guardian could see what you were doing. You write for the Echo and nobody saw it outside Merseyside. That's why a lot of the Echo lads who were very good in the past never moved on, because they were never invited to go to the Nationals.
And when you look at the newspaper industry now, you're out of it by and large. Are you sad that sort of social media has taken over? And
yeah, damn despondent. I mean, I genuinely think within 10 years we'll be lucky if we have 3 national newspapers left. I really do. I mean, I've always been a great advocate of local papers. I go see my kids. I still pick up the free Formby Bubble, which appeared last year, I think, which is, you know, strange, really. They're all closing down, yet Formby Bubble starts up. It's odd. But I just despair now. I do. And I still talk to some of the people I work with who are still working on paper, and they just say, it's gone. It's just gone. All the owners, editors, proprietors, managing directors, accountants mostly are interested in is online or social media. They're not interested in the actual hard copy of the newspaper anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that's borne out by The Echo, which I think their website is stronger than their paper now.
Yeah, and of course you mentioned there the local papers. Mm. I mean, that's where a lot of people cut their teeth, you know, like the Crosby Herald. Or,
I worked there for 6 weeks,
But they've all gone. The Visitor is about the only one that's still knocking around.
I wonder where the next generation of journalists is coming from. He's some guy playing an Xbox in a room somewhere, tuning into social media and doing nothing else. So, you know, most national newspapers now, sadly, have got staff who literally just sit in front of computer screens and monitor social media and write stories from that. That's not, you know, we used to go out and get stories. We used to go out and, you know, Liverpool or Everton signed a big player in the 80s. We would sometimes spend 8 hours sitting at a hotel waiting for the player to come out or for the manager of the day to come out and say, yeah, we've done a deal. I've spent 8 hours doing that. The old moat house on Paradise Street.
Yeah.
We used to do it all the time. But now, you don't do that. You wait until somebody tweets a picture of the player arriving and then having signed, and then you write the story without ever talking to them. You don't have to talk to them because somebody stuck something in his face and he's spoken.
It's changed beyond recognition.
Oh, it has, and
really.
It'll change again. It'll move again. I mean, I'm old school and give me the old parchment and quill and I'm away, but...
So if you've been through the mill as a journalist covering all these different stories and events, you must have been through the mill as a football fan because you're a Leeds fan. How does that feel?
Well, it used to feel great when I was born and raised in Leeds, as most people know. And, of course, I started watching... I think the first game I saw was probably around 64, when Revy had taken over and was transforming them into an absolute dream team. So I had the great fortune of watching Leeds before I left Leeds in... 73, 74. I had the glory years of watching Leeds with my brother, who still goes. He's still a season ticket holder. I mean, I doubt I could name any of the Leeds team at the moment because I'm so divorced from it now. And I became so close to the Mersey clubs. You know, I wrote Howard Kendall's autobiography and History of Everton and stuff. So you become immersed in that. And I'm far more interested in the fortunes of Everton particularly than I am in Leeds. Although, you know, they did okay last season, and I think if they'd managed to hold on to Gary Monk, they may have had a very good season coming up. But I've never even heard of the new manager, but I mean, that's the way it leads. He'll be gone by Christmas.
Well, I mean, it's a revolving door, isn't it?
The sadness is they finally got themselves a genuine, decent, talented manager in Gary Monk, and of course, he walked out because they wouldn't meet his demands or whatever. So sad.
You mentioned that you love of Everton. You became director of communications 11 years. Was that because it was a new challenge after what we've just talked about?
Yeah, I mean, Bill Kenwright and I have known each other a long time, and Bill had been trying to get the club, and I was, even when I was working on the papers, I was on The Guardian then, I was always trying to help him with bits of information I might have picked up and stuff. And he'd always said that if I get the club, I want you to come and work at the club, because his mantra was he wanted professional people in professional positions. And like me, like most journalists of that time, you're talking 2000, 2001, it's only, well, actually 16 years ago, isn't it? Mm. Most clubs didn't pay due respect to media and public relations. You know, you go around so many clubs at that point, and the guys who were running the media were like people who used to sell the programmes and greengrocers and stuff, and they were a part-time. They'd come in and just do it. And, you know, I hate to say it, but Everton were the same. And Bill had always said, this is just ridiculous, because if anybody knows the value of PR, it's Bill, because of his theatrical empire. So he was on at me saying, and then I remember I got pneumonia in Christmas 2000, whenever it was, and I was really ill, and he rang me, and he said, I've got it. I've bought the club. I've got the club. I've bought Peter John. I bought all this stuff, you know. And I was so ill, I'm just going, yeah, I'll ring you after New Year. And then he rang me a couple of times and said, you must come. And I said... But I was on The Guardian then, and The Guardian is the dream paper for writers. That's the paradise for a writer, is The Guardian, because they just let you do what you want. Mm. They trust you to write, because they know if you work for The Guardian, they know you can write. So they'll say, we want 1,000 words previewing the Liverpool. What do you want it on? Oh, we're not bothered. You choose. And it was great, and I loved The Guardian. And he kept on at me and on at me. And then I went to... I went to Bradford City against, I think it was Middlesbrough. It was an FA Cup replay on a Tuesday night. And the chairman at that time was a man who I had not much time for. I can't remember his name. Geoffrey Richmond, maybe? Yeah.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
That rings a bell, yeah. And he'd taken the roof off above the press box He said it was to have some work done, but we wondered. And of course, so we're all sitting there, and it's pouring down. It's absolute. And I realised as I walked to the ground, I got a hole in my shoe, so I'm wet through from top to bottom. None of the phone lines work. We couldn't get the laptops to work. We couldn't get mobile signal. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm wet through. And I thought, what am I doing? And I turned to a good friend of mine, Alan Nixon, from the Mirror, the Sun, I don't know where he is now. And I just said, I'm going to ring Bill Kenwright on the way home and tell him I've changed my mind, I'm going to accept his offer. And I did.
So it was Bradford, Middlesbrough that finally tipped you over the edge.
I just thought, I'm a grown man. What am I doing? Earning a living, sitting in the pouring rain at Bradford on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And it was 0-0, I think. I can't remember.
And you're going from being a journo to the other side of the fence. Is that a culture shock?
Poacher turned gamekeeper. Not really. It was okay because I'd worked for so many papers and because I knew virtually anybody who would be covering Evan, they trusted me and I trusted them. And I told them all, if you stitch me up once, that's the last time you'll do it. I said, I'm not a soft touch. I now work for Evan. But I told Bill when I arrived there, I said, if a journalist rings me up and asks me something which is true or asks for clarification, I will never lie to a journalist who's got the correct story. Mm. I might not give them any information, but I won't deny it. And he said, that's fine. I understand that. Because
it's the whole, and we've all done it as journalists, would I be wrong in saying,
it's like I used to have rows with Kenny. When Kenny Dalglish's manager at Liverpool, he was just a nightmare as the manager. He's a lovely bloke now, and every time I see him, it's great. He's fantastic fun now. But he used to come to you, and he'd say, why have you written that in this morning's paper? And I'd say, well, is it correct? He'd say, that's not the point. Why didn't you ask me? I said, two reasons, Kenny. A, we can never get a hold of you. And B, if we do, you say it's incorrect, even when it's correct. He said, aye, that's right. And I thought, well, there's your answer then. You know, you've got to play ball with people. But no, I really enjoyed it. It was really interesting to move all the sort of suspicions that I'd had all those years about working in a football club were correct. Mostly correct.
What was your remit then when you went in? Did Bill say much to you about, right, I want you to do this, and this?
I was more... we got, a department there, which we built. I mean, when I arrived there, I think there were only three or four people in the department, the press department, media department. I think by the time I'd left, there were 18. So everything had moved internally and expanded with social media. But I was more the sort of conduit between the board and the club and the supporters, more importantly, because Bill was always anxious that the supporters were treated properly and fairly. And so I was given the onerous responsibility for trying to do that. It is the impossible job. And I think a lot of the Evertonians who criticised and abused, a lot of them did me during my time there. I now bump into them in the street and they're all sort of, oh, we realise now it was a ridiculous... It's the impossible job, you know. You can't keep everybody happy.
No.
And they, football fans are football fans. They make ridiculous demands and they expect you to snap your fingers and... It's like, people used to ring up and say, I can't get draft Guinness in the Gladys Street. I say, yeah. Well, can you sort that for me for next week? And you think, no.
What, and you didn't?
No,
you
I
didn't
know.
Sort that out.
I know. What are my great failings there?
Yeah, I'm not surprised you were pulled up on that.
I'm not surprised I was abused in the street.
Ian, we've had a message here from Ken in Ormskirk who wants to ask you, did you go to the game when John Charles played his first game for Leeds? They usually charge 2 and 6, but for this game they charge 12 and 6 because of their big new signing.
I am not that old.
Okay, it was Ken in Ormskirk.
Thank you very much for that.
In the opposition was a striker that couldn't keep on side. His name was Brian Clough.
It was interesting because I was working for You Are the Ref. We were at the Football Museum in Manchester the other day, putting some more people on the Walk of Fame, as they call it there. Famous people are etched into the pavement. And I was looking around there, and the two great omissions were John Charles, in my view, John Charles, and Dixie Dean's not in there either.
Yeah, that seems staggering, doesn't
it?
Well,
I did pull the guy who decides and put him right on straight on a few things. So hopefully that'll be that glaring mistake will be corrected.
When you were at Everton, when you were director of communications, I think you worked with Walter Smith, didn't you, briefly?
Yeah.
And then
David
Moyes. What were those pair like to work with?
Grim Scotsman.
Well, I mean, I used to interview both of them when I was at another radio station not that far away, and Walter actually walked out of an interview once with...
Walter was one of those people who... I say incredibly dour. I think because I came in towards the end of his reign, For some bizarre reason, he seemed to think I'd been brought in to get him the sack.
Right.
And I remember saying to him when he mentioned this, I said, I think you're quite capable of getting yourself the sack, Walter. I don't think you need help from me.
And so you were friends from that moment on, no doubt.
We weren't during his time there, but he came back several times to Goodison, and he was great, not a problem, as though there'd never been a problem. David Moyes, again, is a man fixated on football. To the exclusion almost of everything.
Yeah.
I only ever went out socially with David Moyes once. That was on the first day he started. I took him down to the Tate Cafe at the Albert Dock for lunch, and that was the only time I ever had any social dealings with him. He just doesn't do social. He doesn't do talking. He doesn't do friendship, really, in many ways. He's so fixated on football.
Mm. I mean, yeah. he was in the news recently about the comment to the female journalist, which was obviously he thought off mic.
Mm.
It's just unfortunate, really, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, he's like all managers. You know what it's like. You stick a microphone in somebody's face when they're really angry and upset, they're going to say something stupid. That's why they get microphones stuck in their faces.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
David could be really hard work. I mean, towards the end, we got on really well. I think because I was probably one of the few people who was willing to disagree with him. So we had some classic arguments and rows. Most people didn't, because they just said, OK, David, you do what you want. But unfortunately, I'm not like that. So we had some real stand-up rows, some big ones. But I think in the end, he probably respects you for that, because he's used to people sort of agreeing with him all the time. So somebody actually says, no, you're wrong.
Yeah. Oh, to be a fly on the wall.
It's priceless.
You perhaps don't want to divulge this. Were those arguments about how he was with the media sometimes?
Mostly.
Because that was your job,
yeah,
wasn't
mostly.
It?
Mostly. I mean, the main one I had was where we'd lost at home to somebody, and he simply refused to do a piece for Everton TV. And I said, look, A, we're all on the same side here. B, people subscribe to this. They're paying because they want to hear your views, win, lose or draw. And see, it's a responsibility of yours. You have to do this. It's part and parcel of being the manager of a major football club. And he wouldn't have it, and we almost came to blows, because I just said, you have to do this. You know, this is my job to make sure I provide content for our own television station. And you're denying it. And not only that, I think he told the players not to do it either. So we ended up talking to the cleaner or something. It's just, you know, it's one of those things. It blows over quickly. And I like to think, I mean, I haven't seen him, David, since I left Everton and he left. So, but I like to think if I do, he'd be fine. We'd get on okay. Not, we're never going to be great friends. But I'd like to think there was mutual respect in the end.
I get the impression that Everton is very much your club now.
It is, really. I mean, when I started doing football, when I came to Liverpool in the first place to work on The Echo, my partner at the time was a mad Evertonian, so I was dragged along to games and stuff. And then when I started covering football, I just slotted in at Everton. Jim Greenwood was there, who looked after me, and I looked after him. And I just felt, I don't know, a real affinity. And I'm not saying anything against Liverpool, because they were always fantastic as well. It was just I always preferred going to Goodison than Anfield, in the same way I always preferred going to Main Road than Old Trafford. It's just one of those things.
Yeah.
And then Everton asked me to write the history of the club, and I became very close with Howard Kendall very quickly. We were great friends and spent a lot of time together away from football. I wrote his life story for him, and then you end up going back there working, and it means a lot. People always say that you can't change your allegiance. I'm not saying I don't watch out for Leeds United's results. I do, but I haven't lived in Leeds for. I've lived in Liverpool for over 40 years now, and I've probably seen 10 times more Everton games than I've seen Leeds games. I haven't seen Leeds play since Rooney scored there in whenever it was, a long time ago now.
And Howard Kendall, we're unfortunately running out of time, but you know, great shock for everyone to lose.
That's terrible. You know, he was a really good man through and through. He had his faults, he had his problems. Everybody knows that. But he was a great man, Howard Kendall. When he was a lot younger and when he was fit and active and a young manager, people forget he was player manager at Everton when he first came. He was great fun, but he was a great manager as well. And the players adored him because he had fantastic man management skills. He knew just how to handle them. He knew just where to draw the line with them. And he was brilliant at it. And he did a wonderful job. And I think every Evertonian will miss him. And it was great, you know, his funeral. There were reds there as well as blues, and that's sort of testimony to what Howard was, not just to Everton, but to the city.
And I'm sure as time goes by, we'll look back on him as the greatest.
They're the halcyon days. They're the great days, you know. And I remember that, you know, the famous Coventry game when there were 12,000 there, all shouting for Kendall to go. And Sir Philip Carter stuck with him. And it turned around. Same with Alex Ferguson at United. They stuck with him and it worked.
Yeah.
So I hope Koeman's around for 10 years. That'd be great.
Sticking with managers, it'll never catch on nowadays, will it?
No.
Let's just give your website that you're involved with a mention again. It's youaretheref.com, isn't it?
Yeah, that's that one. And the Wesper one is wesper.uk. I mean, the You Are The Ref one, if people want to have a look at the academy, it's really interesting. It's really worth looking at for any aspiring referees. Not those who expect to make elite level, but any level.